Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by Menlo Park Dental Excellence, providing general dentistry with quality care to all patients, serving patients one at a time with no triple booking, flexible hours Monday through Saturdays, mpdentalexcellence.com.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, gay couples line up for marriage licenses around the state after a federal appeals court lifts a 4.5-year freeze on same-sex marriage.
That was the clerk of Los Angeles, and I just told them that they have to start marriages right away.
Among the first to marry, one of the couples who sued to have Prop 8 overturned. But where does the Supreme Court's Prop 8 decision leave our initiative system? Also, the challenge of prosecuting rape and sexual harassment in the fields of California.
For one, they are afraid that they're going to get deported. Number two, word gets around to the other bosses in the valley that are also doing farm labor work. They'll never work out there again.
It's the California Report.
Virtue of the power and authority vested in me by the state of California, I now declare you spouses for life.
That is Attorney General Kamala Harris marrying Prop 8 plaintiffs Chris Perry and Sandy Steer at San Francisco City Hall. They were the first to get married Friday, 2 days after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down California's Proposition 8. As word spread that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had lifted its freeze on weddings, same-sex couples started taking out marriage licenses. After their ceremony, here's what Sandy Steer had to say.
We have waited a long time for this day. Chris and I fell in love 14 years ago, and we knew that our relationship would last and our family would last, and we wanted our love to last and to be dignified by the institution of marriage. And we've tried to get married, and finally, we got to really get married today.
The other couple that sued to overturn Prop 8, Paul Katami and Jeffrey Zarrillo, married less than 2 hours later in Los Angeles. Soon after the stay was lifted, backers of Prop 8 issued a blistering statement calling the court's action Friday, quote, an outrageous act that tops off a pattern of lawlessness. Here's Prop 8 attorney Andy Pugno.
I think after this week's Supreme Court decision, the initiative process in California is hanging by a thread. And people of all different political views on all sorts of issues should be very concerned that the way has been paved now for government officials to veto measures that are passed by the people simply by refusing to enforce and defend them.
KQED's Mina Kim is at San Francisco City Hall, where those weddings have been taking place. Mina, give us a sense of what's happening there.
Well, a reception is happening of sorts. San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus has just finished filling City Hall with their a cappella music, and it's so fitting because there has been a steady stream of couples who have been getting married. I was actually sitting outside the county clerk's office, and I saw about a half dozen same-sex couples within about 30 minutes. I also ran into a young couple that just got married. They were registered domestic partners, but they stood in line to get their marriage license as soon as they heard that the stay was lifted. And Senator Mark Leno actually approached them to ask them if they wanted him to marry them. And they both, of course, enthusiastically said yes.
So kind of a pent-up demand there. How late will couples be able to go to San Francisco City Hall to get married?
You know, I've still been trying to figure that out, Scott, and I will for you as soon as I can.
You know, actually, it was a trick question because I know the answer, but they're going to be open till 8 o'clock. They're going to be open till 8 o'clock, and they'll be open over the weekend as well. Mina, this is, of course, Gay Pride weekend, and, of course, there was already an air of celebration after the Supreme Court decision this week. What are you hearing from people who are in town just for Gay Pride?
Well, I think a lot of people were coming for the party, and they had no idea that they were going to be here for a historic wedding One young couple from San Luis Obispo, as soon as they heard that the stay had been lifted, had the smarts to rush to City Hall, literally run into City Hall, dripping with sweat, to witness the marriage of Chris Perry and Cindy Steer. And they were saying that it was so emotional and so wonderful to be able to witness history. I talked with another couple who were registered domestic partners but got their marriage licenses, and they said it really did make a difference. It did feel different to have it be a marriage license than for it to be called a domestic partnership. And then one of the two young men was an attorney, and he was saying, and now with DOMA listed, it really is different because now we have access to all of these federal benefits.
Exactly. Well, there's probably going to be a lot more weddings before this is all over this weekend. KQED's Mina Kim at San Francisco City Hall. Mina, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
The resumption of same-sex marriage in California came after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Prop 8 sponsors had no right to defend it in federal court. That leaves one major question. Who will represent the voters' intentions when state officials refuse to? As the California Report's Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow explains, the Supreme Court's decision could have implications for the state's initiative process.
Years of debate over equal protection, over the institution of marriage, boiled down to this. Chief Justice John Roberts and four other justices said the people who put Proposition 8 on the 2008 ballot did not have the right to defend it in court. The proposition's authors stepped into that role after California's governor and attorney general decided not to appeal a lower court ruling overturning Prop 8. Kim Alexander, with the California Voter Foundation, an election watchdog group, worries the Supreme Court's decision could undermine future initiatives.
To decide that the supporters had no standing and therefore could not defend the law sets a new precedent and one that could be exploited by political leaders in the future, by the governor or the attorney general or the secretary of state to simply refuse to defend initiative laws that they disagree with.
Justice Anthony Kennedy had a similar view. In his dissenting opinion, the Sacramento native writes the court's ruling disrespects both the California political process and the California Supreme Court. Kennedy says the decision goes against the basic premise of initiatives, that people, not the government, hold the ultimate power. Author Joe Matthews calls Kennedy's argument a bit too romantic. In his book, California Crackup, Matthews says the problem is California's initiative process is too rigid and too easily abused by special interests. Matthews says the Supreme Court was right to deny standing.
The core message from the majority in the opinion was, California, handle your own business, okay? You know, you created this crazy initiative process unlike anybody else's initiative process, right? And, you know, you should deal with it.
Critics of California's initiative process have been holding up Prop 8 as an example of what's wrong with the system for years now. Loyola Law School professor Justin Levitt says when legislators craft laws, they can air the issues, debate amendments, and reach compromises.
And you get none of those things with the initiative process. It arrives straight up or straight down. Here it is. There's very limited debate on the issues, and there's virtually no discussion of trade-offs down the road.
And that can lead to propositions voters regret or courts reject. Lawmakers, think tanks, and voter advocacy organizations have suggested reforming the process by doing everything from limiting proposition topics to allowing legislators to suggest counterproposals after measures qualify for the ballot. But for a century-old system that's so deeply ingrained into California's identity, any change would be an uphill fight. For the California Report, I'm Scott Detrow in Sacramento.
History buffs could tell you that Prop 8 wasn't the first ballot measure targeting the rights of gays and lesbians in California. In 1978, voters rejected Prop 6, also known as the Briggs Initiative, which would have banned gay teachers from classrooms across the state. One of the leading voices against Prop 6 was San Francisco Supervisor Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in the nation. In this clip from the documentary The Times of Harvey Milk, you hear him on election night in 1978 describing the key to gay rights going forward.
Every gay person must come out. As difficult as it is, you must tell your immediate family, you must tell your relatives, you must tell your friends if indeed they are your friends. You must tell your neighbors. You must tell the people you work with. You must tell the people in the stores you shop in.
Milk was assassinated 3 weeks later along with San Francisco Mayor George Moscone. And if the gay rights movement has its Martin Luther King, Milk is probably him. To mark the 35th anniversary of his death, a compilation of Milk's writings, speeches, and campaign memorabilia has been published. I spoke recently to its editors, Jason Black from the University of Alabama and Syracuse University's Charles Morris. Jason Black and Chuck Morris, welcome.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Jason. How did this project come about?
Well, Chuck and I had been teaching about Harvey Milk for quite a while, Chuck since the late 90s in his social change classes, and me as a doctoral student. I had taught a public address course of social movement leaders in one of Milk's speeches, the Hope Speech, which is pretty popular
and famous.
The famous one that's in the back of Randy Schultz, mayor of Castro Street, was really the only extant one out there. And we'd always had a suspicion individually before we even knew each other that there was more out there. I mean, there can't be a foundational person to LGBTQ history and American history like Harvey Milk without some kind of trove, some kind of corpus of discourse out there.
And you say in the foreword, or one of you did, that you were surprised that it really wasn't out there so much, Chuck. It was the Hope Speech about, you know, you have to give hope to people living in places like Altoona, Pennsylvania, and
That's
that sort
right.
of thing. But beyond that, there wasn't a lot of speeches or writings of his.
We were surprised just how few of the speeches were in circulation. And so when we saw the index of the archive that was finally released in 2003 at the San Francisco Public Library, we were wide-eyed with the possibilities. But even then, we weren't sure what was there until we got here in 2007 to take the first look. And we were amazed at just how much there was.
So most people, to the extent that they know Harvey Milk, especially outside of San Francisco, probably know him through Sean Penn's portrayal of him in the movie Milk, perhaps the documentary that won also an Oscar. What do you think, Chuck Morris, the archives in the book add to what we know and what we think about Harvey Milk?
We think that this book adds to, accompanies, complements, extends what those pieces do.
Jason, what would you add?
That's one of the interesting things about an archival project is that we have a universal storyline or a master storyline and narrative in some way that gets popularized, sometimes glamorized through Hollywood depictions, right, and accounts. But getting to the actual discourse, so the words themselves as uttered by an individual like Harvey Milk, someone that is inimitable as a hero, a personal hero and a political hero, looking at the words on paper, right, the smears of the ink on speech drafts and almost being over his shoulder adds so much contour and dimension to the macro story so that we know, for instance, that he transforms from a populist to a sort of gay-centered and LGBT-centered politician and activist, and then he bridges those together as an elected official, et cetera. But it's really, really neat to see that played out in the discourse as he evolves.
Well, and the other thing is that I think Milk understood his own legacy to the extent that there would be one as teaching us by example how to make arguments. So he understood the symbolism, but he was an issues-driven, by his own insistence, an issues-driven activist and politician. And so this archive, for instance, lays out the ways in which Milk makes a case for greater housing for the poor people of San Francisco or greater gay power in terms of economic might. You don't get that through the very powerful symbolic portrayals. You get that by reading the arguments as he made them.
When Harvey Milk was elected in 1977, he was the first openly gay person to win an election in the United States. Today, there are too many to count. The Speaker of the State Assembly in California is openly gay. There are many, many members of the legislature. There's a U.S. senator. There are several other members of the House. Jason Black, what do you think they owe to Harvey Milk, if anything?
Right. Well, he was a pathfinder. I mean, that probably sounds pretty obvious, right? But he took a stand and stepped out at a time when it wasn't incredibly popular. Now, granted, he was in a place and in a space where it was easier to do that. But
still more risk than you might
imagine. More risk than you might imagine.
Obviously, right? He paid his life for
that. And he paid his life for that. Absolutely. Absolutely. But he carved the way. You know, he paved the way and carved out a space for that. And so in many ways, he's sort of the giant upon whose shoulders folks have stood.
Yeah. Chuck Morris, what would you add?
In part, that he insisted that he was elected not only because he was gay, but because he took stands candidly and openly, publicly on issues, so that I think the reminder he would offer to those that he helped pave the way for would be the visibility politics of your being gay and having been elected isn't enough, that your job is to make the world a better place for GLBT people.
Is Harvey Milk, do you think, Jason, still relevant to young people today?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the hope trope that he's popular for resonates. And the thing with Harvey Milk is he's one of few huge icons that people can draw upon in contemporary debates and contemporary struggles. And so if you think about black liberation, for instance, I mean, you can name tons, everyone from King to Shuttlesworth to X to Carmichael, et cetera, down the line. There aren't really a lot for LGBTQ youth, especially those who are on the ground doing grassroots work. And so in many ways, he becomes not just the face and the name, but the motivation. Mm-hmm. It's, as he mentioned in the Hope speech, he says, you know, my election here and my presence and prescience is a green light. It means a green light has been lit for other folks to move forward, and that's a part of his political will and his understanding of his legacy.
All right, well, the book is called Harvey Milk, An Archive of Hope, Harvey Milk's Speeches and Writings, edited by Jason Edward Black and Charles Morris. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Many of California's estimated 2.5 million undocumented immigrants are hopeful they might become legal residents. The Senate voted Thursday to pass a comprehensive immigration bill that would, among other things, offer a path to legal status and eventual citizenship to millions of undocumented immigrants. Many supporters of immigration reform say without changes to their legal status, undocumented workers are vulnerable and exploited. That's especially true for the women who work in California's fields. We have two stories to highlight that issue, one from the California Report's Sasha Coca and the other from Grace Rubenstein from the Center for Investigative Reporting. First, the barriers to prosecuting farm worker rape cases in criminal court. Sasha Coca introduces us to one of the few California farm workers to testify against an alleged rapist in a criminal trial. A note to listeners, this story contains graphic language.
It started with a missing paycheck. Back in 2006, Guadalupe Chavez was supposed to earn $245 for a week of picking pomegranates, money the widowed mother of two needed to pay her bills. When she went to track down the check, a supervisor she'd never met before told her someone had it out in the fields. He told her to follow him there in her car. This is how she recounts what happened next.
So I followed him to parts of the field I didn't recognize. It's so easy to get lost out there.
She says he stopped in an isolated pistachio orchard, got out of his truck, approached her vehicle, and demanded her underpants in exchange for her paycheck.
He said, I'm the supervisor. I'm in charge here. And I remember that he had told me that he had a gun in the truck. And so when he had said that, and he banged hard on the car with his hand, I thought he's serious. If I don't do what he says, he can kill me.
Then Chavez says the supervisor reached through her car window and raped her with his fingers.
Entonces yo sabía que él me estaba penetrando sus dedos en mis partes y me lastimaba.
It was hurting me. Imagine his fingers were all dirty with pesticides. I wanted for him to stop and hope that it was all he wanted. I thought, if he kills me, who will take care of my children?
After those long, frightening moments, he finally gave her the check. But then, she says, he demanded oral sex from her before letting her go.
All I remember is that I drove out of there really fast, too fast, because I wanted to get away.
2 days later, Chavez went to a rural legal aid office in Fresno about another missing check. Lawyers there said she seemed distraught, and they gently encouraged her in Spanish to tell them what was wrong. Finally, she broke into tears and described the rape. The attorneys urged her to go to the hospital, and she gave them the okay to call the police.
Oh, absolutely, I believed her. Her story was consistent.
Chris Zuniga, then of the Kings County Sheriff's Department, investigated Chavez's case.
Well, Kings County government is saying Avenue, Incident 169, the secret officer.
He's now a sergeant with the police department in Avenal, a tiny rural town southwest of Fresno. As a former farmworker himself, he says he understands why more undocumented women like Chavez don't call the police.
For one, they are afraid that they're going to get deported. Number two, word gets around to the other bosses in the valley that are also doing farm labor work. They'll never work out there again.
And he says most farmworker women don't get a rape exam.
And a week goes by, 2 weeks goes by, 3 weeks goes by, you've lost that physical evidence. So now you're down to a he said, she said. And those are tough, tough to prosecute.
The first stop for a victim isn't often the police station. It's more likely a place like Westside Family Preservation Services, a tiny domestic violence agency tucked into a rundown strip mall in the rural town of Huron. There's a constant stream of women walking in after work in the fields, pulling down the brightly colored bandanas that protect their faces. Caseworker Amparo Yebra says sometimes they'll confide to her about sexual harassment or violence in the fields.
It's going to take some time. They have to feel comfortable. They have to feel like they can trust that they're going to be helped.
Yebra says she literally holds a woman's hand and walks with her into the police station to file a report. But sometimes, she says, victims change their minds once they find out what's involved in a criminal case.
Because of all the questions that they have to go over and over and over about your story, then they send her to another person, and then she has to again talk about the story. Now she has to go to court and again testify against the story. That's very painful.
Even when women do persevere, the odds are long. District attorneys have to decide there's enough evidence to prosecute and prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
If the defense is she consented, those cases are very, very difficult. It's a credibility match, basically.
That's Kathy Ciafini, assistant district attorney for Kings County. She decided there was strong enough evidence to prosecute in Guadalupe Chavez's case. At the time, Ciafini was the county's sexual assault prosecutor. But this was her first farm worker case, and she says the language barrier can be a big hurdle for the jury.
If they're hearing the victim's story in their own language, I think it's easier for them to understand. If they're hearing it through an interpreter, jurors can't make that connection with the victim.
It's hard to say whether that played a role in the outcome of Guadalupe Chavez's case. The man she accused admitted sexual contact, but argued it was consensual, and the jury acquitted him.
Valió la pena, y lo volvería a hacer. Lo volvería a hacer. No le hace que no haya ganado, no le hace que no.
But even so, Chavez says she feels like she got some justice because the man she accused of raping her had to face her in court.
Hubo justicia, o sea, sí se enfrentó a la justicia la persona.
For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
And I'm Grace Rubenstein. Here in Tulare County, one determined farmworker is on a mission to empower women who've faced sexual harassment and other affronts in the fields.
Buenos días. Ya llegamos. ¿Nos tiene una mesa para nosotras?
Oh, claro que sí. Sí, okay. Sí, sí tengo.
It's just past dawn and still cold out when Sandra Garcia pulls her Dodge Caravan into a vineyard northeast of Delano. Just before 7 a.m., the 57-year-old grandmother kneels in the dirt and begins to clip the red bunches. Garcia has worked the Central Valley's harvest since she immigrated from Mexico at age 16.
Now, I don't even want to eat grapes after so many years of picking them.
Farm work is only one of Garcia's jobs. On many afternoons, she goes from a full day in the fields to a meeting of Campesinas Unidas, the United Women Farmworkers of the San Joaquin Valley. She founded the group almost 25 years ago to help farmworker women learn their rights and protect their health and safety. The idea took root when her mother, also a farm worker, died of cancer at age 47. The family blamed her constant exposure to pesticides.
At that time, there was no one to give us information or to tell us how to protect ourselves.
Garcia and her coworkers started meeting on lunch breaks, at first about pesticide poisoning, but they quickly saw the need to tackle more problems.
One time, a woman came crying to us. She said that four men had laid her down in the field, taken off her clothes and abused her. We didn't know what to do. That's when we first wanted to learn about sexual harassment at work.
These days, the campesinas often meet at members' homes. At a recent meeting, 10 women gather on a shaded back patio in central Tulare. Today's topic is heat stroke, but Garcia, as usual, takes the opportunity to hand out a pamphlet on sexual harassment, offering phone numbers of pro bono lawyers. Garcia knows that these women, many of them undocumented immigrants, are reluctant to say they've been sexually harassed. But seasoned members like Raquel Sanchez show the way.
Yo tuve un problema ahora en el...
I had a problem recently. The supervisor was following me around. He was telling me about his life and how pretty I was. And I said to him, you know what? I'm married. I come here to work, not to look for a husband.
Garcia likes Sanchez's attitude and jokes that now she intimidates her bosses, not the other way around. Group leaders like Sanchez are called promotoras. They're trained by lawyers and health workers on everything from minimum wage laws to diabetes. Then they educate other women. When it comes to sexual harassment, Garcia says farm workers often need to know the very definition of the term, including the seemingly innocent ways abuse can begin.
Ya empezando que te da un chocolate. Ningún patrón va a llegar y te va a dar un chocolate, una soda, ¿verdad que no?
It starts with him giving you a chocolate. No boss is going to come and give you a chocolate or a soda, right? At lunchtime, he sits with you. What does he want? No boss wants to sit down with us to eat. So we have to explain all of that.
Since the women are usually too afraid of losing their jobs or being deported to consult a lawyer, their complaints rarely leave the safety of the meeting. Garcia gets frustrated by these dead ends, but she says at least the group's camaraderie can help comfort women in trauma.
We talk about our problems, and then at least when we're all together in the group, we forget about our problems a little bit.
The tireless Garcia often clocks 300 miles a week, crisscrossing the San Joaquin Valley for Campesinas Unidas. The group has grown from its original 30 members to more than 200. They've lobbied in Sacramento for stronger laws to protect farm workers. But Garcia believes change must also come from the ground up.
Es lo que podemos hacer, estar educando las personas.
What we can do is keep educating women so they can defend themselves.
Que no al mayordomo si las quiere tocar.
She hopes for the day when every woman farm worker demands the respect she deserves. For the California Report, I'm Grace Rubenstein in Tulare County.
Those stories were reported in collaboration with the Center for Investigative Reporting and the UC Berkeley Investigative Reporting Program. It's part of a larger project with Frontline and Univision. Check out the links on our website, californiareport.org. And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. Additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Rob Spate. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White and David Marks. Our interns are Rachel Marcus and Carly Naren. Pat Flynn was a contributing editor. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malione and Ingrid Becker. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment, Health Happens in Neighborhoods at calendow.org.